Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This isn't the normal, regular, weekly Risky Business Podcast. The Soapbox series, that's the wholly sponsored podcast series we do here at Risky.biz, where vendors pay us money to get on the show and talk about topics that interest them, or talk about their tech, or talk about whatever, basically. And today we're speaking with Jesse Rothstein. He is the co-founder and CTO of ExtraHop Networks. And ExtraHop these days is a network security play, but they started off more in the application monitoring and performance space before they gradually moved into security over time. And a lot of people still use them for non-security network use cases, right? So it's a pretty flexible tech. In this interview, Jesse talks about network security monitoring. He talks about ExtraHop's history and what people are using the ExtraHop tech to do during the COVID-19 crisis. We also took a fascinating detour into talking about break and inspect, like SSL break and inspect. That was an interesting discussion. And yeah, we went off on a few tangents, but interesting tangents, I think, anyway. So here is Jesse Rothstein talking about the history of ExtraHop networks. Enjoy.
Well, ExtraHop really began life as an analytics platform. We founded the company with this notion, and you know, this was our North Star, that we could extract value out of all of the communications on the network, on the wire, which we like to call wire data. And if we could extract that information in real time, you know, we believed that there were a lot of potential uses. Now, the early use cases that we sold to using this analytics platform were primarily IT ops in nature. So these were delivering a better level of service, proactive early warning, troubleshooting, performance tuning, things like that. And what happened is that over time, we found that a number of our users started using ExtraHop for cybersecurity use cases. And this goes back years. I think one of the first ones I heard about was, you know, way back to the the end of 2014 when Heartbleed came out. We had users that were using ExtraHop to determine which of their servers within their environment had received heartbeat probes and were likely compromised from an information, you know, leakage perspective. We had this happen again with the next big vulnerability, you know, which was shell shock. And I think things really got going when one of our field engineers built a ransomware detection bundle. So an ExtraHop bundle is kind of a set of dashboards and triggers and alerts. And since we were already analyzing the traffic having to do with network file shares, you know, SIFs, SMB SIFs, and NFS, with this bundle, he was able to look for common behavioral patterns for ransomware, something that was, you know, reading and then rewriting a whole bunch of files and maybe changing their names, maybe using some known extensions.
But how are you seeing that on the network?
Well, again, so we understand protocols like SMB SIFs and NFS, and all of that information is readily available if you're paying attention. So that early ransomware bundle was downloaded. And these were pretty simple, you know, rules-based tests, but that was downloaded hundreds of times. And that's what really got our attention for the cybersecurity use cases. So my joke here, if you watch Game of Thrones, is we're the Sansa Stark in this story. We may be slow learners, but we do learn. and that's what we decided, you know, hearing from customer after customer that they were using ExtraHop for the IT ops and analytics use cases, but also for cybersecurity use cases, that we would double down there and build actual investigative workflows for the cybersecurity use cases, build integrations for the response side for, you know, blocking and quarantining. And then most importantly, we'd already been investing in data science and machine learning for really over the last 6 years now. And we had our data science and machine learning team start building out very sophisticated behavioral detections. So if you fast forward, you know, 5 or 6 years to where we are today, now we have a very mature, very full-featured network detection and response offering that also has the full analytics capabilities that you would see in a broad network analytics platform.
So this is the thing, right? That's the secondary use, right? Like the network-based IDS is like the secondary use of this thing. And I've spoken to people on security teams who talk about ExtraHop. You know, and ExtraHop has been brought into the environment by the networking team, but it's like the networking team have this shiny red Porsche. And they let the security guys have the keys every now and then to take it for a hoon, but it's not something that seems to belong to one team or the other. Well, normally with the network side, but the security people get the benefit from it. I mean, have I got that essentially right?
Well, we've seen it both ways, and sometimes we like to coin the term SNOC when we see that, you know, where you have the security operations center and the network operations center sharing. So sometimes they go in together, you know, halvesies or something on the budget. Sometimes one or the other will bring it in. We've definitely seen that push or pull. But going back to what you said about the, you know, the network intrusion detection system, you know, IDS is it's almost a dirty word right now.
But people still want them, right? People do still want them. Like it's
no. People have to have them, I think, for regulatory reasons. But it's very rare, if ever, that you speak to somebody who likes their IDS, because more often than not, the IDS is a very noisy alert cannon. You know, it tends to run off of very primitive rules and signatures, and it just generates noise all day. And I think the challenge with the IDS, since again, it also tends to analyze the traffic at the north-south corridor, you know, the front door, is IDS is really detect the attempts and not often the success of an attack. And the problem with running an IDS at your front door, at your perimeter, is that, you know, it's the internet, and the internet is unbelievably noisy. I mean, the barbarians are always at the gate, and they're always banging on the gate, and they're always jiggling the door handle. And if you get an alert every time somebody jiggles the door handle, that's not really something you're likely to pay a lot of attention to.
Well, I mean, that's if you're deploying a, you know, IDS to the front of your like web servers. Sure, you're going to see a whole bunch of stuff, but you know, plenty of people run them on the gateway and stuff. You know, like that's a pretty typical use case.
And they can add a bit more value there. Certainly, if you see internal systems that are you know running attacks, hopefully that gets your attention. More often than not, it's your vulnerability scanner, and it's just your daily alert that you're running your vulnerability scan. This is where I believe that the market has evolved. I think we saw this movie kind of play out in Endpoint, where Endpoint went from relatively simplistic rules and signatures for antivirus and really evolved to, you know, very sophisticated behavioral detections for EDR. I think we're seeing the same thing play out from, you know, that evolution from IDS to NDR. And I don't want to spend a bunch of time talking about pie in the sky, fancy machine learning. I think we're all tired of hearing about that. And we don't anymore. But
I'm kind of a bit of a skeptic on all of that stuff to a degree, right? Like I think that obviously there's a role for stuff to be observed on the network. But I think the way that you've just expressed that makes a lot of sense, which is it's a similar shift to what we saw with Endpoint just happening on network now, which is the whole lot is getting fancier and hopefully a little bit more useful. It makes sense.
Well, how could it not? We have access to more data than we've ever had access to before. We have access to, you know, more sophisticated algorithms. Machine learning, I think it's often overhyped and oversold, but that doesn't mean that there aren't very real things that you can do.
Well, I mean, the single best thing that it can do is like, you know, in this context is alert tuning. It's very good at alert tuning. It's fantastic at alert tuning.
It's good at alert tuning, but I would actually say that it's very good at behaviors. What the type of machine learning models that I like are behavioral models. And you can, you know, you can look at behaviors in terms of how a particular, you know, device, endpoint, asset behaved in the past. You can start doing sophisticated peer group analysis to understand who are its peers and then how does it behave relative to its peers. You start building predictive models. You know, the way that we work at the highest level is that in an enterprise environment, even a medium-sized one, we might have upwards of 1 million predictive models running for how we expect things to behave. And then when they're behaving very differently than our expectations, we know something strange is going on. And that sort of approach just beats the pants off of a threshold-based or even kind of some sort of dynamic baselining type of alert. Mm-hmm. It's a better way of doing it. It requires a lot more data. It requires a lot more processing power. But it is a better approach.
So look, I mean, there's more to talk about here than I guess visions of machine learning based network IDS, right? Because there is some pretty crazy stuff happening in the world, which is having a huge impact on the way computing is done. Obviously, I'm talking about this massive shift to people working outside of the office. And even though it's likely going to be temporary in much of the world, the fact is, those users need to be provisioned somehow. We're seeing people do it the smart way. We're seeing people do it the stupid way. You are in an excellent position to tell us, to give us some insight here. What are you seeing through this COVID-19 crisis in terms of the massive shift to get people working outside the office?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, it is a massive shift, a forced shift, but I think it's also an extremely abrupt one. So many companies in so many parts of the world had to make this shift, you know, almost overnight or with very, very, very little warning. So in kind of the beginning, which seems fairly distant, but for many of us was maybe 6 weeks ago. Initially, we just saw organizations trying to do this as quickly as possible. You know, how can I deal with a situation where everybody in my organization is going through the VPN or the identity aware proxy or the VDI or maybe all three?
Well, and you remember Azure was in some regions was running out of resources, and a big part of that was just the huge uptake in Teams, like dragging the whole thing down, right? Like it was pretty crazy there for a couple of weeks.
Exactly. So all of the initial use cases that we saw among our customer base seemed to be kind of performance tuning use cases. Mm. You know, is this working? Are people, are users experiencing a good level of service? You know, are there bandwidth hogs? Who's hogging all the bandwidth? Is there something else? We saw situations where people were watching live video camera feeds through the VPN. You know, that might be an example of consuming a bit too much bandwidth if you do a lot of it. Over and over again, we saw that those sorts of performance tuning cases. But then more recently, they've started to give way to actual, you know, security use cases. And we've seen
This is interesting, right? Because I got like a little, you know, we've bounced some stuff back and forward before the interview. And, you know, you've described it in terms of phases, right? And phase one was like, make it work. And phase two looks like it's the, okay, well, maybe we want to lock it down. that seems to be the idea here.
Absolutely. Phase two is either we want to lock it down or we want some assurance that we have locked it down. I think most organizations are going to have some policies in place for the remote users. But the question is, do they have those configured correctly? Are they actually working? So something like a network detection and response analytics platform like ours can answer those questions. And then you see a lot of really strange misconfigurations. A lot of organizations might have some form of split tunneling configured. This is where you send only a subset of the traffic through the VPN and the rest of the traffic through your public internet gateway. But if that's misconfigured, you might end up seeing a lot more traffic going through your data centers than you anticipated.
That's interesting because we have seen that pop up. I've seen a lot of people popping up on Twitter talking about, you know, the split tunnel problem and getting, you know, you would absolutely get some visibility on that with your stuff, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. And we've seen some great ones. We saw ones where the endpoint agents were supposed to send everything to a big data lake, you know, in the cloud, but instead sent everything through the VPN and basically took it down to its knees. With just a torrent of traffic. We've seen some other situations where some organizations who I think were very forward thinking actually started shipping out to their remote workers work from home devices. And in this case, access points that were pre-configured for the VPN. But they weren't expecting users to put all their personal devices on it and then these personal devices to start accessing corporate resources. So that's a great example of maybe not anticipating some of the implications of your actions.
Yeah.
So, and then finally, kind of a belt and suspenders approach. You know, even if you have the remote workers in place, even if you have the VPN, the identity aware proxy, you know, the VDI, there is still danger that through credential theft or a variety of other attacks that, you know, you are more vulnerable than you were in the past. So the belt and suspenders approach is really having some extra visibility into what the VPN users are doing, you know, which resources are being accessed, and if any of those patterns are unusual. You know, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about actually building predictive models for which resources are accessed, you know, which peers you might communicate to. If you have a user in the finance department who maybe has VPN access or some form of proxy access, and then they all of a all of a sudden start accessing other resources, maybe organ, you know, I'll pick examples like source code, which they've never accessed before and nobody in the peer group of finance users should ever access, chances are you're going to want to know about that. So I believe in, you know, in so many of these situations, I think so much of security is not the tyranny of the or, but it's the genius of the and. You know, should you have audit logs? Of course you should. Should you have policies in place? Absolutely. But should you also have kind of a belt and suspenders approach where you're analyzing the traffic and analyzing the actual usage patterns for individual users? No doubt.
I feel like, you know, that's an interesting idea, right? This idea that you can have some network device that's automatically putting users into various peer groups and spotting when things are going rogue. But, you know, it feels like at the moment, people are just trying to get stuff to work. And that is like light years ahead of what they're trying to sort out. I mean, like a very real world use case that you guys have told me is popular right now is using your gear just to spot RDP, you know, to make sure that people are not doing unauthorized like RDP. I mean, that's a thing that people are doing, right?
You know,
I mean, you're talking about all of this fancy stuff, right? And then I'm like, well, hang on, RDP.
I haven't even gotten into the really fancy stuff. I can't help it. The good news about the fancy stuff is that fancy stuff is tough when you have to go through a lot of trouble to deploy it and a lot of trouble to configure it. The things that I'm talking about happen out of the box. You know, the beauty of these machine learning models when done right is that they learn based on past behaviors, based on the environment. They're self-tuning. You don't have to spend a lot of time configuring them. But you're absolutely right. Low-hanging fruit. Do you want to spot unauthorized RDP? Sure, you can do that. Do you want to analyze the usage patterns for, you know, basically unsanctioned collaboration tools? Yes, we can do that. We can recognize those tools. We can even recognize some misconfigurations and common ones where maybe something like encryption is not enabled. I don't want to pick on particular tools, but it's surprising that there are some collaboration tools where configuration has to be enabled by the administrator and it's not on by default.
I mean, that's a very handy thing, right? To be able to understand what sort of protocols, applications, and services your users are moving to when they're expected to do their job without being there. It's like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
But if you'll permit me to talk about some of the cool stuff, Patrick, I think the really cool fancy stuff is when we can actually auto discover when we can auto discover when VPNs are present, auto discover which of the, you know, assets in your environment are maybe the VPN gateways. And then when it starts getting really cool is that when we can start correlating internal VPN clients to the external basically IP addresses and origins. And yes, you can do that somewhat by trolling through log files and doing some integrations. But what we found is that at every organization we talk to, that's a headache. And it's always difficult to do those point in time correlations because you have to kind of go back and say, well, you know, what IP address did this client have at this point in time? And then where was it coming from? And we've got some very fancy correlation that can automate that whole process. And I think it's just, I think it's unbelievably cool.
Now, I believe you've got some anecdotes about some customer actions through this whole thing.
I think I told a couple of the anecdotes already. You know, probably the ones that are top of mind are the examples that I gave you. You know, examples of misconfigured split tunnels that took down the whole VPN. Examples of a whole lot of personal devices that start accessing corporate resources because. Maybe you shipped a certain work from home.
The BYOD thing is interesting, right? Because like that seems to be where it's been settled is companies basically need a BYOD policy and that's how they can cover this off. But that was always going to happen because a lot of these workers who were sent, you know, to all of a sudden not be able to work in the office, they didn't have company issued laptops and there was a run on laptops and no one could get any. So of course they're going to come in with their own devices. That was something that, you know, Blind Freddy could have seen that coming. I'm surprised people were caught on the hop.
You're absolutely correct. I think a large number of organizations were forced to very quickly relax some of their BYOD policies.
Yeah.
In this particular case that I'm thinking of, a Wi-Fi access point was kind of shipped to remote workers that was then pre-configured for that was pre-configured for VPN access. So that's almost inviting a little more BYOD than perhaps even the policy might allow.
Now, I want to ask you a question because, you know, obviously a lot of people have, you know, opened up VPN gateways and, you know, they're using VPN gateways that used to have a handful of users. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's using them and people are bolting in new VPN concentrators, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder, though, if you've seen that a lot of customers of yours are all of a sudden kicking off more in the identity aware proxy direction, right? Because it sort of feels like at this time of crisis, right, we've needed a tool to enable work from home. And obviously the go-to tool is a VPN, but everyone's spinning them up going, you know what? This is insane because it's kind of an old way of doing things. Are you detecting that vibe? Are you picking up on that vibe as well? Because it feels like VPNs are kind of on the nose. Like they just feel risky now.
I feel the same way. Well, I don't know if they feel risky, but they definitely feel like they're falling out of favor. Mm. Identity aware proxies, certainly in the industry, I get that vibe. You know, whether it's the whole kind of Google Beyond Core design, or whether we're talking about identity aware proxies, you know, in the cloud through some sort of secure, you know, web gateway provider.
Well, but I mean, you know, what I like about that is that those approaches are compatible, right? You can sort of be heading in the zero trust direction and, you know, still use an ID aware proxy to get to some of your legacy apps. And it all, you know, it's a sort of nice blended architecture at that point, you know, whereas you throw a VPN into the mix and it's like, ugh.
No, completely agree. I'm seeing that move in a couple directions. So there are one set of organizations that are looking at the secure web gateways. So that would be kind of the Zscalers of the world, the Netscopes, the Palo Alto Prismas. You know, you run a secure web gateway, it's a managed service that one of these providers provides, and that's all through the cloud. And I think that some of the public cloud provider and CDN providers like GCP and Cloudflare are trying to get in on that action as well. But then the other approach is I think we are starting to see some identity aware proxies on-prem that have the added benefit of you can use that on-prem when everybody is in-house as well, also when they're running remote. So we're seeing both. I think there are a couple of interesting identity aware proxy open source projects that I hope start gaining some momentum. So we'll see a little bit in terms of which way that, you know, how that unfolds, but that is a big trend. I would hazard the guess that many, 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 maybe even most organizations have that rolled out to some degree for certain services. But then I think we're still in this transition period where it's not everywhere. So you still have to fall back to your VPN from time to time when you need to access another service.
Yeah. And that's the thing, isn't it? Right. Because it is clearly a much more elegant approach. It's interesting that you mentioned an open source, you know, that there's some open source projects on this, because really I feel like a lot of the value from these ID aware proxies is the fact that you're able to access them from like the edge of a giant CDN. Right? Like good luck DDoSing that, you know, DDoSing someone's VPN gateway right now for shiggles, you know, pretty easy. I had this friend a long time ago and he never used to like eating food with his hands. Like, you know, like food like crab or like chicken wings or stuff where you had to pick it up. He's like, what are we barbarians? You know, he just did not like eating food with his hands. And to me, you know, using an old school VPN at the moment, it sort of feels a little bit like eating with your hands, you know?
Well, the DDoS argument's interesting. I think at the end of the day, anything can be DDoSed if you know where to hit it.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. In the case of like Cloudflare, are you going to DDoS Cloudflare or Akamai? Yeah, it's harder, right?
Not Cloudflare, Akamai, but at somewhere there's got to be a tunnel back into your organization and maybe there's a gateway there.
Yeah. So, that's a good point.
So somewhere there's a pipe from your organization out to the cloud. And then the trick
is about finding out where it is, right? And what the idea
exactly,
is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But no, I think if we start seeing traction on the open source projects, it'll likely be due to the pricing model. You know, yeah. A number of the identity aware proxies are not inexpensive and some of them charge by the byte. Some of them don't. But that, you know, the pricing model is such that it could add up or not. It really depends on the organization. And quite honestly, I don't have a horse in this race.
No, that's why I'm interested in what you have to say, right?
I'll tell you where I do think a lot about the identity aware proxies is when they're married to the secure web gateways. because the secure web gateways perform break and inspect for your SSL TLS encrypted traffic. And that there's something about the break and inspect. It's a very inelegant solution. I gave a talk about this at the RSA conference, whenever that was, at the end of February, I think, you know, which was probably the last physical conference many of us attended. And it's a challenge when you're talking about client traffic, you know, for clients that you control, that is, you know, exiting and transiting the internet in some way, and you want to analyze that traffic, and that traffic is encrypted, it's very, very hard to get a look at it. And with modern cipher suites, where that traffic is encrypted with a cipher suite that supports perfect forward secrecy, and even with TLS 1.3, which only supports cipher suites with perfect forward secrecy, it becomes extremely difficult to get a look at that traffic unless you perform some form of SSL interception. So the question is that something that employers should do?
It seems like it's pretty much standard these days, is for break and inspect at the gateway, right? Like, this is a standard thing. What percentage of your customers do you think are actually doing that? Because I'd imagine it would be quite high.
So it's hard for me to answer for our customers. I wouldn't want to disclose that. But what I will say is that Cloudflare did a study that indicated, and they had to infer it, but it indicated that about 20% of all traffic that Cloudflare saw in their network appeared to have gone through some form of SSL TLS interception. And that's pretty significant when you think when you realize that's not just, you know, companies, you know, it would be companies, it would be schools, it would be a lot of personal traffic as well. So there absolutely is an awful lot of that going on. And, you know, it's a very fine line to walk. And I want to try to avoid some of the broader privacy implications. But if we do look at the security implications, it's not always the case that they do a good job. You know, sometimes they're actually lowering your security posture.
There was a bunch of bugs recently, wasn't there, in one of those gateways that turned out to be, and this pops up every few years. I think there was one recently, but I remember a few years ago, someone looked at one of these boxes that did the, you know, TLS break and inspect. Most of this kit is pretty bad, is what I'm getting at.
Some of it is and some of it isn't, but there have definitely been situations where it's going to re-encrypt with a less secure cipher suite, or maybe a certificate that is, we've seen things break when the re-encrypted, when the certificate, the dynamically issued certificate, you know, might be for a cipher suite that is certainly less secure. There are lots of situations where, because you've broken kind of the end-to-end integrity of the encryption, it means that the client can't verify the integrity of that certificate anymore. It doesn't know that the original certificate is still valid, it hasn't expired, or that it's actually coming from the correct issuer. It certainly breaks things.
Well, that's the job of the gateway at that point, is to do those checks. And I mean, quite often they fall down, right?
Yeah, if it is. And then, of course, many of these, you run into this perhaps a little less with the managed services, but if you're running a system yourself, that means that you have to have your own certificate authority somewhere. And that certificate authority needs to be trusted and valid on all the endpoints. And, you know, running a certificate authority means that private certificate, you know, the root certificate, needs to be highly guarded. Otherwise, you're making those users much more vulnerable. There's a whole list of potential pitfalls here. And I'm not saying that every vendor runs into them or every environment is insecure, just that there are a lot of gotchas. Yeah. And from the user's perspective, it can be pretty difficult to ensure that you've got, you know, good end-to-end trust, because
this is what makes it an interesting topic, right? And I remember some years ago Cisco putting out a paper where they were able to reliably detect C2 without breaking TLS. Like, they could actually just look at some behaviors coming off hosts. And this is years ago, right? So I imagine the state of the art is substantially further along now.
Cisco's still pushing that. They have a capability that they call I believe ETA, encrypted traffic analysis. And it's exactly that. It's traffic analysis. When we look at network traffic that's encrypted, there are still a reasonable number of features that can be extracted and analyzed. The individual packet framing and segmentation. You can analyze some of the options at the various, you know, transport layer and session layer protocols. You can certainly analyze the flow of data. So there are certain things that you can very reasonably detect. You can very reasonably detect the difference between a large data transfer and a small amount of interactive traffic, right? And there are other signals that you can pull out of that. And Cisco is not the only vendor that talks about doing this. I do
Stephen,
think
Stephen Ridley
vendors,
built a classifier that could reliably pick up encrypted like SSH interactive shells out of network traffic and stuff. And he said it was very reliable.
So detecting things like interactivity is very reliable. So we have that capability in the XTROP system, and we can detect interactivity. And it's one of the ways that we can find things like interactive, you know, web shells that you might not be expecting, or reverse shells. But this is where I will say that I do think a number of vendors, including Cisco, overstate what can be done with encrypted traffic. Because the traffic is encrypted, and if it leaked as much information as these vendors said, then encryption wouldn't be working very well.
Yeah.
And the truth is, for malware in particular, you know, we can pull out some fingerprints, things like JAW3 fingerprints, and JAW3S on the server side, that the hash SSH fingerprints, and those are somewhat useful to determine which cryptographic libraries and in some cases which clients and servers are associated with the connection. But if you're any sort of reasonably sophisticated malware author, it's not hard to make your payload look like a browser.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to use pretty standard cryptographic libraries. And it's really not hard to cover your tracks. So I'm really skeptical that encrypted traffic analysis can do very high quality malware detection.
I think
lot of those claims are overstated.
So where do you land, I guess, is the question on the whole idea of break and inspect. I mean, not that it's going to make a terrible, you know, terribly massive, huge difference what we say on this podcast, but, you know, I'm just curious, if you were the CISO for a, you know, say medium to large size enterprise, which way would you go?
Well, I would say start with why. What are you trying to accomplish? If you're trying to secure services and servers that you provide, then it's completely unnecessary. You control that infrastructure. So, you know, build a proxy layer or use some products that have decryption capabilities. You know, ExtraHop has very sophisticated real-time out-of-band decryption capabilities, but only for services you control. So if you're trying to secure services you control, it's completely unnecessary. If you're trying to provide a layer of analysis for in particular, BYOD environments where you want to see the traffic that these BYOD devices are accessing, and it's insufficient to look at things like the IP addresses and the host names and other signals, then maybe do some breaking and inspecting and determine why. But this is where you want to be really careful that you're not looking at private information like people's, you know, accessing online banking or health records or things that you're very likely going to want to filter out of that. So I would say start with why. What are you trying to accomplish? And, you know, if you're trying to do this for laptops that are company property that you've issued, then maybe it's necessary, but maybe the EDR product
that
you've deployed is completely sufficient.
We've got EDR now. Like, I mean, if EDR is certainly not something that I think is a panacea, but if there's something that it's good for, it's kind of blowing away the requirement to do break and inspect. I would have thought that's one of the things that you can achieve with it.
It is. And I think a dirty secret in the industry is that a number of very large web services do perform some amount of certificate pinning where, you know, you can't do break and inspect. And we're also seeing this more and more on apps on smartphones, where they'll do some form of certificate pinning, not for greater security, but because they want to make it more difficult for you to reverse engineer what the app is doing. You know, they want to make it harder for you to run something like a Charles proxy and see what the protocol looks like. So even though HTTP public key pinning has fallen a bit out of favor, we still do see a fair bit of certificate pinning for either big online services.
Yeah, like gmail.com, that's going to be pinned, right?
Yeah, so what I'm saying is, even with breaking and inspecting, you might not get it quite as much.
You're going to be heavier on the breaking than on the inspecting, I think, is what you're getting.
Start with why, but if it's a service that you're trying to control, that you control and that you're trying to secure, it's unnecessary. If it's laptops and equipment you issue, it might not be necessary. But in a BYOD environment where you absolutely need that visibility, maybe for regulatory reasons, then it's probably the best solution we have.
For reasons, it's just funny what you said about someone sort of obfuscating an app. For reasons that I won't get into, I've been spending a lot of time looking at macro static scanning lately. And what's interesting is the macros that are really likely to be flagged as false positives, it's quite often because it's some quant guy at a big bank whose crazy macro is like, you know, that guy's workflow, you know, in macro form, and it's their IP. So they obfuscate the shit out of it, right? Because they're worried someone's going to steal the IP in the macro, so it looks like malware. It's just really funny once you start drilling into like where some of these false positives come from, right? And why things are the way they are.
Absolutely. A lot of complexity everywhere. And sadly, I think as humans, we tend to generate more complexity. It's pretty rare that I see any trends that create less complexity.
So we're kind of getting towards the tail end of this thing. You know, for the listeners out there, there's a lot of CISOs obviously listening to this, a lot of people who are responsible for the security of their organizations. Like, why should they buy your stuff, right? Can you give us your best elevator pitch for why a CISO might want to take a look at ExtraHop?
Well, certainly I'm a huge believer in network security, and very specifically network detection and response. And the reason I'm such a big believer is that the network has all of these great properties that you don't see in other sources of data. To what I said earlier, you know, it's the genius of the and, not the tyranny of the or. Should you look at your log files? Absolutely. Should you have a SIM? No doubt. You know, should you install endpoint agents? Yes. But the network is as close to ground truth as you can get. If we observe something on the network, it happened. The network is extremely difficult to tamper with, and it's almost impossible to turn off, certainly without anyone noticing. And these are fabulous properties when it comes to a security device. And then network detection response has advantages that we don't see in other areas for, you know, things like BYOD, where maybe you're unable to install an endpoint agent. Maybe you don't have sophisticated enrollment for, you know, mobile device management. And then I think one area where I'm extremely long on network deployments, and this might be surprising, is public cloud. For many, many years, we didn't have a lot of network visibility in public cloud.
Oh, no, I know. And it's just, isn't it great that it was Azure who did it first with their, what's it called? Their little network tap thingy?
The Azure VTAP.
Yeah.
And then
the
AWS's VPC traffic mirroring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then GCP's packet mirroring. And nobody is happier about that than I am. I had been asking all three major cloud providers for years to do this.
No, everyone had. And it's, what's really funny is like, it basically, all of the network people basically got propelled from being kinda, not really, but kinda thought of as legacy tech a little bit into like the new hotness when the cloud providers finally realize that no one's going to use their stupid Lambda crazy logging, right? And that they're going to actually have to cough up some packet data.
But here's what's so exciting about that is that now, and perhaps for the first time in history, it is actually much, perhaps infinitely easier to deploy a network-based solution than it is to start baking, you know, endpoint agents into your various images or to do other deployment models. Because with something like traffic mirroring, you just configure the traffic mirroring and point the traffic at.
Oh, no, I get it. It's fantastic. Like, and it's just such a shame it took so long because everybody, you know, all those cloud providers, they were expecting people to do things their way, right? And people never did. So stuff was getting missed. And then it's like, okay, fine, here's your tap, right? And everyone's pretty happy about that.
My view, I was optimistic for a long time, Patrick, but then I was starting to get concerned because I believe that in the fullness of time, there was nothing useful that we could do on-prem that we wouldn't eventually be able to do in the public cloud.
Yeah.
But it surprised me that it took so long because, of course, you know, we've been able to take, you know, port mirrors and spans and VACL captures on-prem for so many decades, and it took a very long time before we could do it in public cloud. But now that we can, it really opens the door for some very innovative deployment models. This is where I'll say that with ExtraHop, we have our ExtraHop RevealX 360 offering, which is a SaaS offering. You point the traffic to us, And we're able to do all of the management for that very broad analytics platform.
So
and
that's our, instant
the network detection and response capabilities.
Yeah, so that's like what instant IDS and network monitoring for your public cloud deployment, just pointy clicky your way there, sort of thing.
Instant, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great, and it's interesting, right? Because we do have one other network based security company that we deal with here on Risky Biz, and it's nice when you hear everybody's on the same page with regard to selling the advantages of what's on the network. That concept of ground truth, that concept of, you know, these are the logs that are least likely to have been messed with. You know, I think it's great that now. It's interesting because, you know, back in the day, network security was considered, you know, basically the whole game, right? And then there was the big swing against it. And now it's like, feels like networks found its place. You know, isn't that heartening?
You know, we see this a lot in the security industry in general. We see a lot of new technologies that people get very excited about, but then they end up being features and not products and rolled into something else, you know, time and time again. But I do believe that network security is a fundamental, you know, product space. You know, it is a fundamental source of data. It's a fundamental product, and I believe that we'll see the relevance for that data source for a long time to come. That said, you know, is there value in log files? Sure. You know, should you deploy EDR? Absolutely. This is part of a much broader strategy.
Yeah, and I think it's good that we've matured as an industry beyond that point where, like, the solution is this or the solution is this. It's now it's, you know, it's a little mix of this and a dash of that and a pinch of this, and, you know, that's how you get there. So, Jesse Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us to have this conversation. I can say I've genuinely enjoyed it. It's been really interesting, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Patrick, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it as well.
That was ExtraHop Networks CTO Jesse Rothstein there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out ExtraHop Networks at extrahop.com. And that is it from me this week. I do hope you enjoyed this podcast. But until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.